I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
No. Uh-oh. I'm in my pajamas right now, so.
I'm wearing a hoodie.
So, yes.
I just came back from outside, actually. Finally getting some nice weather over here.
Where to go, Logan?
Huh?
Where's outside?
The patio. My.
Logan's in Nashville.
Yes, gotcha. I'm in Nashville. It's like 65 degrees outside. Got to turn on the fire pit and sit out on the new fancy patio. So that was nice.
I got excited when it hit 45 and I put on a light jacket. I mean, so.
Isn't it a great feeling?
It really
is. Yeah, that's kind of been winter here this year. It has not been cold. All it's done is rain. And it kind of sucks because we were going to go running this weekend and all of the greenways are flooded. Like my greenway that I do do my normal like 12-mile loop, is under 10 feet of water. So
that's just it. Now it's just turned into like a Spartan race for you. So you just run through it,
right? Mud it up, you know.
I don't think you can run through 10 feet of water. I think you swim
not
through
with
that.
Not that attitude. You can't.
All right. Well, then just go triathlete. Swim through it.
Yeah.
Yep, grab your bike, ride down to it, swim through it, then run the way home.
There you go.
Yeah.
We've solved your problem. No more excuses.
That year seemed like it was like, I'm not doing
like,
that.
No, it's not happening.
Yeah, it's, I'm not sure what to do. I guess I could just go run a circle around my neighborhood, which is, you have to run 3 times around to get 1 mile.
Oh,
so,
no.
So that would be a lot of running in just to do 6 miles. That's 18 times. I don't know if I
your
could
neighbors
do that.
Would think you're probably crazy.
Yeah, they probably would. Plus it's all hill. So we live on the side of a hill. So the first part of the loop is down and the second part of the loop is up. Quite steep, so yeah, there's no flat. It's very rough. I mean, I suppose it would be really good hill training, but
You got some nice interval training going in there. You could also hit the local high school and run the track, right?
I could.
That's 24 loops for 6 miles though, so.
that's
definitely more boring.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there was going to be a 5k that I did not get in time. I don't know how they're going to do it, but it's called the BNA 5K. BNA is our airport, and they're actually closing one of the runways for you to run down and then back up.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I thought it was cool, too. I mean,
but
you're never
like
going to...
But super boring, right? Like, I feel like there's nothing to look at.
There's never going to be a better time to beat your personal record, though.
That's true.
Unless you can find
flat.
A 5K that is perfectly downhill. Because there's nothing flatter than an airport runway.
And right? Super straight. You're not winding through anything. You have to make any turns. Interesting.
I also imagine that would be one of the hottest 5Ks because of how black that asphalt is and how
that's
much heat
true.
Would be coming off it.
Well, it's in like early April, so mid-April. So it's going to be like 60s. So it shouldn't be horrible. April's always a hard month to determine because it's either 75 or like 30. So Tennessee weather is weird.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I mean, it's either 60 degrees or 3 feet of snow in New York. So
New York is New York. It's an interesting place. I've been there several times.
Not where Steve is. So I just realized that would be a good segue to have him introduce himself.
Yes.
Fair enough. So my name is Stephen Ostendorf. I am the director of graduate admissions at Bank Street Graduate School of Education in Manhattan. I live on Long Island with my family, and I commute. And so the interesting part about my commute is I'm in 2 hours in and 2 hours home on a daily basis.
Oh, God.
So my part-time job is riding trains. Trains.
Good.
Yeah, no, my part-time job is definitely the Long Island Railroad and the MTA. So I wish I could say I was getting paid for that, but I do pay them for the privilege.
That is a lot of Netflix. If you watch Netflix on the way.
Yeah, I had a 45-minute commute once, but I was driving, so I couldn't really do anything except listen to podcasts. So what do you do on a 2-hour commute?
So the luxury on the way in is when most people are waking up, I'm on my first nap of the day. So I get, I'm up at 5 and I'm taking a nap at 7. And I'm sleeping all the way into the office.
Oh my gosh.
Which is fantastic.
That's amazing.
On the way home, depending on what's going on, it's either I listen to a ton of podcasts or I am doing homework because I'm in a doctoral program, an online doctoral program out of Northeastern. So I keep myself nice and busy on the train ride home.
Yeah. So many things to talk about when it comes to that. Are you like going in that early because you're trying to avoid the peak times?
No, I'm going in that early because if I leave at 7, I'm in the office by 9. So I get in on time.
So, didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, that's just the way it works.
Wow. Good on
that is intense. Mine's 45 and I think that's crazy. Of course, I only live 13 miles from work. So there's
that. I mean, it's really all perspective though.
Absolutely.
So if in the morning I can get that ability to get that extra nap in, I'm well rested by the time I get to the office. Mm-hmm. And on the way home, if I have a particularly bad day or if I have a frustrating day or anything, that 2 hours of decompression means that when I get home, I'm not bringing that day home. So it can be really, really great because if I was driving, I'd hit even more frustration. I'd have more the traffic, the knowing that it's just, I'm that far away, but I can't do anything about it. I can't move any faster. There's no extra way I can go. It could be even more frustrating than I get home and I'm frustrated. Where with the train, it is what it is. I have no control over it. So just sit back, relax, do a little homework, listen to a podcast. And when I get home, I get home.
That is very insightful. I like that. Yeah, I like that you get to decompress.
Yeah. And the other side of it is, and this, maybe this is just me justifying things to myself, but if you love what you do at both ends of the commute, it makes it a lot more palatable.
Hmm.
So if you love home and you love your job, you want to get to both.
Mm-hmm.
The commute's not quite as bad. If one side of it's horrible, it ruins the entire thing. The whole equilibrium is lost. So
I totally feel that now that you say it, because I used to have to take the bus home from work, and I won't say how long because I used to complain about it. But after hearing you take 2 hours to get home, I'm not going to complain anymore about how long it took me. And I would kind of dread coming home because that meant I had to start doing homework, and it made the bus ride miserable.
Mm.
I didn't realize that until now.
Yeah, and commute distances are completely relative based on your experiences. So for somebody who gets frustrated at a 20-minute commute, that's their lived experience, and that's perfectly okay. No matter how long mine is, it doesn't make yours better or worse.
So. Right.
I just wish that I had mass transit so I could ride something to work.
I don't know. Maybe, Steve, you have a different answer than this. It sounds nice, I think, when you put it that way of like, oh, I get to, do my homework and things, but I got to listen to podcasts and read my book on the bus, which was great. But I also was like a slave to the bus's schedule. Like if the bus was late, I was late, especially coming home.
I think that's what he's saying is that's the freeing thing about it.
No, for me, it was not freeing. It was stressful.
Well,
sometimes it would take me like twice as long to get home as it did the day before. And you can't like account for that when you're trying to get somewhere, at least for me.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely have been nights where I've left the office on time. Normally I'd get home just after 7, and I'm not home till 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night because of a derailment, a car hit a train, a pedestrian gets hit, or there's
weather. A lot of death that happens on your commute.
Or there's weather.
Well, there's the person who dies. There's the person who then caused themselves to die. There's the train that derailed and killed all the people. That's very... See, I don't at least... I don't... I guess people die when they're driving to work, but that's, you know, in Nashville, we do have like one commuter train, which like goes to like Lebanon, which absolutely, you guys have absolutely no idea where that is, but it's just a town out there. And I think the worst thing that usually happens is they hit a deer, but like the deer just becomes like a splatter and it's just kind of messy when they get off the train. But I think that's the worst I've ever heard. Our problem is the train just doesn't work. Like, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, we get that too. Signal problems, and it's snowed, so the train.
How do the Japanese do it? That's my question.
And the Germans. I mean,
the Germans too.
They always talk about the German train schedule. I mean, it's just perfect. And so, I don't know. Whoever it is didn't design the railroad, that's for sure.
No, not at all.
We're living in the 1850s with our steam engines, and they're riding 120 mile per hour electric magic maglev trains.
Well, you know, when Elon Musk finally gets the Hyperloop together, you know, maybe we'll all be saved.
One day.
Maybe. I think that's what Nashville's waiting for as far as mass transit goes.
I mean, that makes sense though.
Yeah. I mean, we had an okay proposal. Not good, not awesome, not bad, okay. And we voted it down. And now there's still no good mass transit. So, but they're fixing our interstate. Let's add more lanes. That'll fix it. It won't fix it.
It's a start. So, Steve, how long have you been commuting?
So I've been doing this commute for the last 4.5 years.
Okay.
Prior to that, I worked what was the equivalent of about 10 miles from my house, and that would take me 45 minutes to an hour. So no matter what, there's always been a commute, but this commute has been about 4.5 years.
Well, I feel like in my experience driving on Long Island, it's never a quick ride anywhere.
No.
Car or train or whatever.
No, there's only so much real estate on Long Island, and that's being sucked up by strip malls, suburban sprawl, and more highways.
Yeah.
But there's also more and more people every year on the island. Although they say that it's starting to shrink because of taxes and the cost of living, but I'm not seeing it.
Isn't Long Island sinking, or am I wrong? Not that I wish that upon you.
I don't know if we're. I mean, inevitably, sure. Global climate change is going to make sure that you know the Poconos will be the coast at some point. But I don't know if it's. I mean, erosion, sure. I mean, between Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Irene, and a bunch of the other storms that have come through, we've lost a lot of our beaches and our barrier beaches. But you know, people are resilient. They move their houses up, they throw down more sand, and just kind of hope that their property values.
Yep, I was going to say, cross your fingers and just see what happens.
See, now I'm looking it up because that's interesting.
I haven't heard too much about sinking, but I could be completely wrong.
I could have also made that up. I'm sorry. This is how rumors are started. My fault.
I mean,
Google say?
I mean, sea levels are rising.
Sure.
I don't know if that means it's sinking.
Well,
isn't that relative?
I mean, I guess that everything's relative.
Isn't that like glass half empty, half full?
According to some guy named Einstein, it's, you know, relative. I believe the geologic term for it is subsidence. It's subsiding. Okay. So that means it's going down. And it happens. Islands do sink.
I feel like we've talked about a lot of morbid things in the first like 10 minutes. So maybe
only some like train death.
Want me to flip it?
Let's flip it.
So since you've been commuting for 4 years, I'm going to assume you've been in this role for 4 years. True?
I've been in this role, a similar role at two different institutions, but yes.
Oh, okay. So I'm curious, kind of like, what's your, I like to ask, like, what's your day-to-day or, like, what's on your desk right now? Like, what's going on campus?
Oof, right now.
Right this very moment.
At Bank Street, the biggest thing that we're working on is, for the first time ever at the institution, we're taking some of our teacher ed programs online.
Ooh.
So we've been working with a partner, a company that's really helping us do a lot of the heavy lifting here. But I'm in charge of helping with the admissions, enrollment, recruitment, and marketing side of that. So I'm working with them on some staff development on their end. They're going to work some inquiries and some leads and really try and help us in that area. Because from a scale perspective, it's going to increase our work in the office. So we're doing a lot of reading of Google Ads and ad copy, emails, training manuals, just a ton of work to try and really get this ramped up. We launched our microsite 3 days ago, so
in the middle of the
first week of March. And it's been, so far, it's been an exciting experience, but it's just it's a heavy lift, especially at the time of year when we're supposed to be reading applications and getting people in the door. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because I was like, wait, isn't this the time that folks are, this is like deep into application season, right?
Yes, it is. So I have some of my staff, so we've realized that we need to divvy up the work a little bit and move some things around. So my senior associate director is taking on the heavy lifting around reading and working with applicants and moving things through. We've gotten some help from some people around the office. So one of our assistant deans is helping out with reading. Another administrator is helping out with reading. And so we're really sharing the work around. And it's been so nice to see the cross training. It's been so nice to see people understanding other sides of the job instead of just saying, well, they do this and they do that. Now it's, oh, I really understand what they do now. So. Mm-hmm.
So what you said, you're bringing some of the courses online or programs online? I'm sorry.
Programs. So
wow.
Bank Street's been around for a little over 100 years. As a graduate school, it's been since around the 50s. Mm-hmm. And we're very old school. Mm-hmm. We've got a very progressive pedagogy, but that progressive pedagogy is reliant very heavily on in-person communication, in-person conversations, in-person advisement. So there's been a very big resistance to doing anything that would remove any of that in-person work. But over the last few years, there's been more courses going online, more ability to do interviews by Zoom and Skype, and people have started to really buy into the idea that we can deliver a top-notch education program at a distance. Whether it's synchronous or asynchronous is a way to do this. Mm-hmm. So we've put a lot of time and effort in the last year and a half to really build out the courses, build out the programs, and now build out the marketing.
That's such a heavy lift. So how did you, what was like the first step in deciding, okay, we need to start moving some of our programs online?
Well, that stuff came from more of an academic side than the administrative side, where I would sit. So it took a commitment, I'm pretty sure it came out of a commitment in the strategic plan 5 years ago, or four and a half years ago.
Which makes sense for it to be happening now.
That's right. And I think the statement that in the strategic plan was expand Bank Street's reach more nationally and globally. So that was the impetus. And how do we do that? And that's, you take things on.
To the internet.
Yeah, well, we're not going to open up sites around the world, although we have some small programs and partnerships with schools around the world. Mm-hmm. The only way to really expand our reach when it comes down to taking our message on the road is through the online. Where it gets difficult is New York State certification doesn't really apply outside of New York State. So I think our market's going to be more Schenectady and Syracuse and Buffalo and Rochester, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a number.
Those are all other places in New York too.
Those are all other places.
Good job, Logan.
It's all upstate.
Long Island?
No. All the state. Schenectady and the other ones that aren't Long Island or the city. I learned that. Everything else is upstate.
Upstate.
If you're from Long Island, that's true. Anything north of Westchester would be considered upstate. But
yeah, I'm not going to get into it.
Downstate, Buffalo is technically Western New York.
Yes.
So there's more names than just upstate and the
and
city.
Downstate, so. Yeah.
Well, upstate the city in Long Island.
Yeah, well, most of New York doesn't believe Long Island's part of New York anyway. So
Steve said it, not me, listeners. You heard it. You heard it. I wasn't going to say it, but Steve said it.
We did have a discussion once that it's just a glacial moraine. So
we are just glacial till. That's all we are. That's true.
Can just go on its own. We're fine.
No wonder it's sinking.
No wonder it's, well.
That's why us Western New Yorkers just spread the rumor that it's sinking.
Yeah, that's still up for debate. I haven't seen the evidence in that. I need to see some empirical evidence.
I did find
that
a study.
Good point, though. Going back to your point about the fact that your New York State certification really doesn't have a widespread audience, that's such an interesting point that I didn't think about. So it also, though, kind of helps because I would assume folks that see themselves working in New York but maybe aren't living there can then take the time online to stay where they're living and make that transition, right?
Absolutely. So if you have somebody who, like, there's a lot of students who grew up in New York City or in New York State who have traveled out of state for undergrad, who may have fallen in love with the city that they're living in, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, Nashville, Austin, and now the opportunity to get a Bank Street education while they're still in those cities where the cost of living is less, would be an amazing opportunity for them. Where it becomes interesting is there are interstate certification where they will accept New York State, you have to take their test, or you have to apply through their system, so there is some reciprocity. But we're gonna work with the students as much as we can on that, but those rules change so often. It's impossible for Bank Street to stay up on all 50 states. Mm-hmm. So the students are really going to have to own that for a bit until we can figure it out. And I think what we'll end up doing is really, when we do our marketing, is focusing on those states that we know either has a much easier certification process when it comes to taking New York, or just focus in the full state of New York. And New Jersey, Connecticut, where we know the reciprocity rules.
Well, the interesting thing, at least about you guys, is that you have such a big state that sets this tone for so many things in education already. Like Texas is another state that tends to set the standard. California too.
Yeah.
And those three states are really big on that, just because I know that, especially for elementary schools and stuff like that, when it came to Common Core, like New York kind of set the standard on curriculum for Common Core for many, many, many states. Just because they were the best equipped and the best funded to help develop curriculum models and such. At least that's what I heard from someone once when we were discussing such things. So who knows if that's actually true, but, I'm sure someone will not tweet us about it on Twitter, but yeah.
That was a tweet.
So I do think it's an accurate statement. It's definitely not a very Bank Street thing. Bank Street doesn't believe in the standardization of education. We're much more progressive, and we believe that students should be active participants in their own education. So students and teachers working together to help the students grow in the classroom versus become proficient, which is really where Common Core comes into play. But our Bank Street teachers, you know, understand both the non-progressive pedagogies as well as the progressive ones, and we work in that way. But the I think the better example of what you're talking about is New York City is leading the charge on pre-K for all, and right now they're working on 3K for all. And when back in 2014. 2015, when they went to Pre-K for All, New York State contracted with Bank Street to help train 4,000 early child care educators on the Pre-K for All model. And we're working with them now on the 3K for All. So, you know, access to early childhood education and the ability to help students and help kids grow and develop and really come into their own in the early child care space is what Bank Street was founded on.
That's awesome. And I think that's a powerful message that probably resonates with a lot of people.
It does.
And I mean, not just folks wanting to come to school there, but I mean, maybe that's how we should be looking at education in general, you know?
Bank Street thinks that way.
Well, obviously. yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah, I've got nothing to add.
I was going to ask if students are like participating. I've seen a couple people that live in that area, rallying the troops online about this, about Pre-K for All. Are students getting involved in that?
So are graduate students in mm-hmm. working that way? Well, yeah, I mean, a number of our graduate students teach in Pre-K for All classrooms. You mean from an activism standpoint?
Yeah, I didn't know if there were any like clubs on campus that kind of work in that like activist type way. Graduate students, I feel like, have a lot more flexibility. Not that undergraduate students can't participate and be activists, but you know, just in their positions and how they interact, especially in education.
I think at the moment, not quite as much. We don't have a huge student life aspect to what we do. We work primarily with working teachers. Mm-hmm. So they're in the classroom all day long, and then they're going to school at night. They have families at home, and you know, so they're not quite as involved that way. But they are working on activism projects on their own. A number of our students were at a number of the women's marches and marches throughout the city over whatever else has been going on the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So there's that side of it, and our Council of Students has been working a lot on social justice, race, and ethnicity and equity and that kind of work. And they've been doing a lot of work with the administration and the faculty, inquiry groups, and really just trying to understand more about how that impacts them as students, the institution, when it works between the faculty and the students in advisement, as well as what they can bring to their classrooms.
That's awesome. Something you said sparked me that I had a question for you. Speaking of working with working teachers who then come to get their master's, you are a working professional that is then getting your doctorate.
Correct.
I'm curious about that process for you.
It's very slow. Yeah, I started fall of 17, and I've taken 5 classes. So, as you can tell, I'm slowly going through this. You know, I'm working on my EDD. I'm focused on organizational leadership studies. Really working to really build my leadership acumen and try and figure out change management. I think that's going to be my focus is how do we combat the mentality of, well, I could change, but it's a lot harder to change than it is just to do this thing in the wrong way. So I'm just going to keep doing it the wrong way. So that's what I'm.
Well, when you move the cheese, when you move the cheese, it makes people uncomfortable.
That's right.
And yeah. Cheese is important, and it needs to stay in the same place in the maze so that we can always find it.
No, you have to move with the cheese. I've watched the little cartoon video. I understand what's happening here.
We just have to become comfortable in our discomfort.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
As I learn in yoga, you have to be comfortably uncomfortable. That's what they describe basically every pose as. And I'm like, everything is just uncomfortable. I'm not really sure how to feel. So.
Isn't that just exercise in general?
Yes. Well, no, there's like yoga uncomfortable. And then there's like Logan running in like 10 feet of water uncomfortable, I think.
That is uncomfortable. Difference. That is very uncomfortable.
So
you're wet and there's the chance you might get cholera. I mean, there's lots of things.
Again, we're back to it being morbid, Logan. Keep it up. Keep it positive. Keep it light.
Positive. Positive. Positive.
Are you running or on the Orion Trail?
That's dysentery. Well, I guess you
Logan
could get
apparently
cholera
has
too.
A time machine and takes it back 100 years to do his workout.
Well, we have antibiotics now, so that's a plus, I guess. But I mean, I don't know. It's been an interesting week at Belmont, I guess. Let's see here. We had two people on American Idol that are going to Hollywood. Both Katy Perry said top 10, so yay. And then our women's basketball team is going to the NCAA tournament, so that's awesome. The other thing was men's basketball might one day if we make the bubble, so that's going to be stressful. But anyway, back to doctorate, because I was curious about that. Why are you doing your doctorate? Obviously, you want to get better at leadership, but like, why specifically beyond that? And are you liking it? Because I'm looking at going to get some kind of further degree, and I'm still kind of, I don't know what I want to do. So I'm asking you advice. Is it worth it?
Yes. And I don't mean to hesitate there, but the truth is, this is something I always told myself I would do. So part of this is just proving to myself that I can do it, which is...
An expensive thing to do. Sorry, I don't mean to toss that out there, but see, that's one of the things holding me back. So,
so if you're investing in yourself, that investment's going to pay you back.
Is it because you know? Am I a good investment, Jackie? I don't know.
Are you looking for reassurance?
No, that was a joke. I am full of myself. More often than not, but sorry to interrupt, but
everyone's been speaking on my behalf all episode. This has been great.
Fair enough.
No, I agree though. It is an expensive investment. I'm with you, Steve.
It is, but it's, I do believe that that education always pays off. And so for me, part of this is, you know, I love what I do. I love higher education. I love working at colleges. I love the impact that I have on students. But I've been doing it almost 20 years now. Mm-hmm. It's time to start thinking about what the next step is.
Right.
I mean, I've increased my responsibilities and increased the work that I've done and increased my abilities and my status in the field considerably since I started back in 2001. But my title has pretty much been the same the entire time. I've stayed in the director realm. I was a director of admissions and student services, I started as a director of student affairs. I've been a director of student affairs since 2002. And I've been a director of student affairs, director of student services and admissions, a director of campus life. I've been a director of admissions, a director of graduate admissions since then. I spent a couple years in marketing where I was a director of business development or a higher education vertical manager. But for the most part, my title hasn't changed now.
What is a higher education vertical manager? Just curious.
So I worked at a marketing agency where I managed all of their higher education clients.
Okay.
So my job was to really be a project manager on all of those accounts, work with our digital team, our traditional team, our creative team, to make sure that everything that we were doing was being delivered on time. So
that is a fancy word for that. Sorry, I was just curious. Please continue.
It was a great job. I love the marketing side of things. The problem with it was I did not feel the same fulfillment. I loved the work. I wasn't happy with the work that I was doing. You know, I mean, I learned so much. It made me a much better admissions director. It made me a much better higher education professional. But my calling is to help people. And I didn't feel like I was doing that on the marketing side. I knew I was in an indirect way, but not in a direct way. So that's what brought me back to higher ed. So get back to the grad school piece. I am back in school because I'm really just trying to figure out how to do better at what I'm doing now, and see what comes from that later.
That sounds a really nice way to end. We normally end on such an uplifting note on the show. It's like 9 times out of 10, even though we always talk about morbid things apparently, and that feels like the right ending for me. How about you, Logan?
It's a good ending. I like it.
That's fair. I like it too.
We'll see. We're so thankful that we had the chance to chat with you between all your busyness in your life. We're glad that we got to connect with you. And listeners, we're glad that you stuck around with us today. You can head over to our website. We're at highered.social. You can find links to all the cool stuff we talked about today, and connect with Steve, and also subscribe to our show there or anywhere you get podcasts. And if you like the show, please leave us a review. We really appreciate it, and it helps other people find Higher Ed Social. And of course, if you want to follow us on Twitter, please do. We are at HES Podcast. Send us a tweet, say hey, answer Logan's questions, give him validation. And if you want to be on the show, let us know. We love meeting you, and we want to meet great people that work in higher ed. As always, a big thanks to Emma Hawes and Mariah Barksdale for their awesome help with the show. Also, Higher Ed Social is part of the Connect EDU Network, which is the first podcast network for higher ed. You can visit the website connectedu.network and subscribe to some really amazing shows pretty much anywhere you work on campus. So hope you enjoy, and we'll see you next week.